that wouldn't stop her from telling if she thought it'd get her something, even if it was just the satisfaction of seeing me get a beating. How could I sleep? I went back to tying my sash with sluggish fingers. Did you know that you snore? Olea snorted under her covers. See, I told you, she shot at her half-sister. Sometimes I almost liked my next youngest cousin. We used to get along just fine back before I lived under my uncle's roof, and hating me became one of Aunt Farah's household rules. Though maybe that wasn't you last night, I jabbed at Shira. Hard for a pile of blankets to snore. Shira's bed had been as empty as mine when I'd clambered back through the window, after using some of our precious water to scrub the smell of smoke and gunpowder from myself. Judging by the sickly sweet smell of oils on her, she'd been out to see Fazim. He'd probably told her he was going to the pistol pit and coming back rich. I tried not to smile at the memory of him getting pitched from the competition. I wasn't even sure Fazim had made it out alive. We were at a stalemate. I wouldn't tell, so long as she didn't. After a moment, Shira flopped back onto her bed and started pulling a comb through her hair, ignoring me. I was running my fingers through my own mess of black hair as I made my way into the kitchen. The boy cousins were already starting to mill around on their way to work, shouting to one another over the prayer bells. No one who worked in the factory had time for prayers, except on the holy days. I snaked around my cousin, Jiraz, whose uniform was half on, half knotted around his waist, as he scratched at a healing burn across his chest. He'd gotten it from one of the machines a few months ago when it belched fire at him unexpectedly. He was lucky he'd lost only a month of work instead of his life. I grabbed the tin of coffee off the top shelf. It was mighty light. There was sawdust mixed in to thin it out, too. My stomach tightened. Things always got bad when food was low. Actually, things were always bad. They just got worse. Farah? Uncle Asid walked into the kitchen, rubbing his hand across his face. Nida, his youngest wife, trailed behind, eyes on the ground, hands over her pregnant belly. I turned my attention away just in time to pretend I didn't notice my uncle's eyes drag along me.
Is there coffee yet?
Desperate restlessness filled me. I wasn't staying here. No matter how light the coin purse I wore tied against my middle felt after last night. Give me that! Aunt Farah snatched the tin with one hand, the other smacking me sharply across the back of the head. I winced. I told you to go open the store. You hear me? I couldn't not hear you. I stepped out of her reach, not that it had saved me from a beating later. I was glad to get the hell out of this house and out of my uncle's sights, but I couldn't stop my smart mouth. Any louder and the whole town could hear you screeching. I let the door clatter shut behind me as I dashed down the steps and into the street, Aunt Farah's threats of a switch to my back fading with every step. My uncle's shop and his house were at opposite ends of Dust Walk, which was a whole 250 paces to walk. Dust Walk's single street was as crowded as it ever got, what with the men trudging to the factory and women and old folks rushing to the prayer house before the sun burned away the last of the cooler night air. The familiarity weighed on me. Lately, I'd been thinking someone just ought to kill this town out of mercy. No steel was coming down from the mountains. It had been years since the last Buraki was spotted. There were a few regular horses left to sell. They weren't worth a whole lot. There was only one thing I'd ever liked about Dust Walk, and that was all the space outside of it. Beyond the flat-faced, dead-eyed wooden houses, you could run for hours and still find nothing but scrub and sand. I resented it now, how far it was from everywhere else. But when I was younger, it had been enough just to get away. Far enough that I couldn't hear my father slurring that my mother was nothing but a used-up foreigner's whore who couldn't give him a son. Far enough that no one could see me, a girl with a stolen gun, shooting until my fingers were sore and my aim was good enough that I could have knocked a shot glass out of a drunk's shaky fingers. The furthest away I could ever get was when my mother used to tell me bedtime stories of Isman. Only when my father couldn't hear. The city of 1,000 golden domes, with towers that had scratched the blue off the sky, and as many stories as there were people. Where a girl could belong to herself, and the whole city was so rich with possibilities that you almost tripped over adventures in the street. She read me the stories of Princess Hawa, who sang the dawn into the sky early when Isman was attacked by nightmares in the night. Of the nameless merchant's daughter who tricked the Sultan out of his jewels when his father lost his fortune. And she read me the letters from her sister, Sophia. Sophia was the only person I'd ever heard of who'd gotten out of Dustwalk. She ran away the night before she was meant to be married and made it all the way to Isman. Letters came from her in the capital to my mother with a caravan every once in a blue moon. They talked about the wonders of the city, a bigger world and a better life. Those were the times my mother would talk most about Isman. We were going to leave and go and join Sophia someday. She stopped talking about it on the hottest desert day anyone remembered in a long time. Or maybe just one of those days that folks remembered so well after because of what happened. I was as far into the desert as I could get without losing sight of the house. The sun was glaring so hard off the 6 empty glass bottles I had lined up that it was making me squint, even with my shima pulled up to my nose and my hat low over my eyes as I took aim. I remember swatting at a fly on my neck as I heard 3 gunshots. I stopped, but I didn't wonder much. This was the last county. Then the smoke started to come up. That was when I ran back into town. My father's house was on fire. Later I'd find out my mother shot my father in the stomach 3 times and then dropped a match to the house. But all I remembered understanding then was relief when they dragged my father's body out of the house. He wasn't even my real father. I remembered my mother trying to run to me before they dragged her off, my throat going raw from screaming when they put the noose around her neck. Dreaming about the places my mother talked about stopped being enough when the trap door dropped open below her feet. I was just about halfway across town when I noticed the crowd forming in the big gap next to the prayer house, where the house I grew up in used to be. I spotted Tamid's 2 neatly parted dark hair through the crowd. I shoved through bodies until I was next to him. People tended to stand clear of Tamid, like they thought they might catch a limp from him. It left that much more room for me. "What are we staring at?" I moved to take the place of the wooden crutch under his left arm. It worked fine and all, but the stupid boy kept getting taller, and every time somebody bothered to build him a new crutch, he'd go and grow again. He flashed me a smile that I returned with a stuck-out tongue. "What's it look like?" He passed the crutch back to Haifa. She was the only servant in town, on account of Tamid's family being the only one that could afford both to buy food and to pay someone to cook it. He rested his weight against me. Tamid was pale as sin for desert folk, but at least his tall, skinny frame looked less hunched today. At first, in the glare of sunrise, all I saw was the familiar blackened brick of the Sultan's weapons factory on the edge of town. The only reason the hellholes around here were allowed to exist was to serve the factory. Then I caught the glint of the sun on polished metal. The Sultan's army was coming. They marched in lines of three abreast down from the hills. Their gold shemas covered them from the sun, and their sabers hung from one hip, guns from the other. White zouave tucked neatly into their boots, and gold shirts cinched at their hips. Their march was slow but inevitable. It was always inevitable. At least there were no blue uniforms dotted among the white and gold. Blue uniforms meant the Galen army. The Sultan's army might not make life easy, but they were still Mirajin, and we were their people. The Galen were foreigners, occupiers. They were dangerous. Politics and history weren't exactly what folks talked about in our end of the world, but the way I heard it, our most exalted Sultan Oman had figured 2 decades back that he was better suited to rule Miraji than his father. So he made an alliance with the Galen army. The foreigners killed his father and anybody else who refused to bow to him as Sultan. And in return, he let the Galen army set up camp in Miraji and take the guns we made to go off and win their wars on far-off shores. Aren't they back from Sazi a bit soon? I squinted into the dawn, trying to count them. Seemed like there weren't as many as usual.
You didn't hear? The pistol pit and Deadshot burned to the ground last night.
I stiffened, hoping Tamid didn't notice.
There was some riot. My father heard this morning. Something to do with the rebel prince. He says the army is coming down from the mountains to sort it out.
To hang drunks and gamblers, you mean? The Sultan's army had passed through on their way to Sazi only a few days ago. They'd gone to see the mines, probably to find out if they were worth salvaging. It was unsettling to have them back so soon. Normally, the Mirajin 15th Command came through every 3 months to collect the weapons the factory churned out and take them for the Galen.
Deadshot was always a bed of sin. They had it coming. I was meditating this morning on the golden city of Habadan.
Tamid's voice took on a righteous tone. He had a tendency to read the holy books until the spines were worn, and I swore he'd started preaching at me more than the Holy Father did lately.
Their people were so corrupted by wealth, they turned their backs on God. So God sent the warrior Jean to cleanse it with their smokeless fire.
Sure. Then there were the less holy stories of Jean seducing women, stealing them from fathers and husbands, and carrying them off to hidden towers. Those were the good old days. Nobody had seen a genie in decades. Now all it took to burn down a den of sin was a girl, a foreigner, and a whole mess of drunks.
See?
Tamid went on, sounding more like my chiding friend again.
I bet you're glad you listened to me about going to the pistol pit.
I screwed up my face. It was as good as admitting guilt. His expression dropped.
You didn't.
Shut up, will you? I looked at Haifa, who seemed a little too interested in staring at Tamid's crutch while pretending not to listen. You want to get me hanged? When he sighed, I felt his disappointment.
So that's why you look like an exhausted wreck this morning.
And folks say you're not much of a charmer. But I scrubbed a hand over my face all the same, like I might be able to rub away evidence of last night. I could have won. I leaned in close to Tamid so nobody would overhear. If they'd played halfway fair.
Didn't say you couldn't, Amani.
He didn't share my excitement.
I said you shouldn't.
It was an old argument. We used to have it back when my mother was still alive, when she used to talk about Isman. We stopped having it after she died. I didn't bother telling Tamid I was still planning on going.
Not until the night I overheard my uncle. After scrambling away from where I had been crouched below the window, I headed straight for Tamid's house. I'd climbed through his window like I'd done since I was old enough to be able to jump to the windowsill. And just like always, Tamid greeted me, trying to look exasperated and failing. I told Tamid I was running out of time, that I needed to get out now or never. While I talked, his expression turned less joking. Tamid had never really understood my need to get out of Dustwalk. Of all folks in this godforsaken town, he should have. That night, he said the same thing he always did. No matter where we went, nothing could change what we were. A cripple and a girl. If we were worthless here, why would it be different anywhere else? I tried to tell him different, about the letters from Aunt Sophia, about a better life, about better things than living and dying in this dead-end desert town. But for someone so filled with holy zeal, Tamid wasn't really the blind faith sort. So I let him figure he'd converted me and didn't tell him I was planning on strapping my chest down and making a run for it, one way or another. I wasn't like him. I had to believe Isman was better than here, or there wasn't much point living anywhere at all. Now Haifa cleared her throat. "It's not my place and all, but you're about to be late for prayer, sir." Tamid and I traded a look, both of us stifling our laughs like we were kids in a classroom again. "Lateness is a sin, you know," Tamid said with mock sternness. In school, Tamid and I were late all the time. We used to try to blame his leg, and our schoolteacher used to scold us that lateness was a sin. We might have been frightened, except he told us everything was a sin. Tamid had read the holy books 3 times over, and as far as he could find, neither lateness, nor talking in lessons, nor falling asleep in school was a sin. Still, Tamid took the crutch back from Haifa as she tried to usher him toward the prayer house and away from me. "We're not done talking about this," Tamid called as I turned to walk in the opposite direction. I spun long enough to give him a mocking salute before I dashed across the scorching sand toward the shop. I tossed open the iron gates at the storefront before kicking the door open to get as much sunlight inside as I could before going in. I checked around the bags of salt and shelves stacked with tinned things swimming in thick juices that made them last unnaturally long, watching for any shadow that might move. The doors and windows of the store were edged in iron, just like every house in the last county, but that didn't always stop things from crawling through in the dead of night. In the desert, you learn to look out for ghouls in the shadows. Ghouls came in 1,000 different forms. Tall, faceless skinwalkers who'd eat a man's flesh and take his shape so they could feast on his family, too. Small, leathery nightmares who sunk their teeth into sleeping men's chests and fed off their fear until the soul was sucked out. Iron was the only thing that'd keep them out. It was the only thing that'd kill them, too. They hid from the sunlight. The only thing that would really do the trick was a bullet to the skull or an iron knife through the ribs. Iron turned all immortal things mortal, powerless. That was how the Destroyer of Worlds killed the first beings. And that was how humans, in turn, killed the Destroyer of Worlds' ghouls. There weren't so many ghouls as there used to be. The last person to get killed by one round these parts was 10 years ago. But every once in a while, one would crawl over some break in the iron and into the corner shadows of a house and get a bullet to the head for its troubles. Once I was satisfied that the shop was as empty as a drunk's bottle, I popped open the door to get whatever breeze there was before dumping out what was left of my money on the counter. It came to 6 fuzza and 3 luzi, no matter how many times I counted it. That wasn't enough to make it out of sight of Dustwalk, let alone to Isman. Even if I emptied the shop till and didn't get caught, I wouldn't make it that far.
I needed a new plan, and I needed one soon. The iron bell on the door rattled, giving me just enough warning to swipe up my pathetic collection of coins before Pama al-Yamin came in, herding her three boys. The day wore on with painful slowness while I tried to think my way out of Dust Walk. By late afternoon, my chin was dipping to my chest as the heat tried to drag me down into sleep. The sound of hoofbeats made me look up, just in time to see a handful of soldiers clatter past. I scrambled up, my mouth dry. Tamid said the army was coming to deal with Deadshot, so what were they doing here? Had somebody told them about the blue-eyed bandit and pointed them the way of the only girl in the desert who could have played the part? A shape dove into the shop as fast as a shadow, plastering itself in the blind spot between the door and the window. I felt for the rifle Aunt Farah kept below the counter. The man didn't come for me, though. He stayed so still, I thought he might have stopped breathing. Another horse rode past without looking in the direction of the shop. I waited until it was clear before speaking. "Fine day for hiding." He spun around. His badly wrapped shima fell away from his face, and I saw him clearly in the late afternoon light that leaked through the window. My heart did a strange little jump. The foreigner. I schooled my face to look impassive. He gave me a smile that didn't match the tension in his shoulders.
"Just needed to get out of the sun on a day like this."
His voice was sure and smooth, like I remembered from last night. There was no hint of recognition there, and I felt a flicker of disappointment. "It's not a big town, you know. They're bound to look here sooner or later." "I'd guess sooner." Another horse clattered past, then slowed, looping around. It came to a halt outside the shop, and the mounted soldier called something out. Two more horses came into view. A muscle in the foreigner's jaw twitched. The knife at his side was the same one he'd taken off Damad last night. When he saved me, and I'd left him to fend for himself. "You might want to find a better hiding place." His hand was still playing with the hilt of the knife when he looked up, questioningly. I stepped back, nodding at the gap below the counter. The soldier was dismounting now. In the second that his back was turned, the foreigner dashed across the short space between the door and the counter. He vaulted over the counter and landed so close to me, I felt his shoulder brush mine before he ducked down below. I quickly adjusted myself, so I was standing square in front of him a second before the soldiers entered. The first one stood in the doorway for a long moment, looking in every corner of the tiny place, the other two flanking him. Finally, his scrutiny landed on me. He was young. His hair was combed back more carefully than most soldiers, and he had a round face that made him look soft. But the gold sash across his uniform told me he was in command. "Afternoon, sir," I said in my best shop girl voice. I was keenly aware of the foreigner below the counter, trying to quiet his breathing.
"Commander to you."
His hand twitched, and he turned the gesture into a straightening of his cuffs. "Can I help you, Commander?" I'd learned young to give the army false respect. The two soldiers who'd followed their commander took up position by the door, like I might make a run for it. One of them was older and looked every inch a career soldier, stiff back, dark eyes straight ahead. The second one was younger than his commander, maybe even younger than me. He slumped in a uniform that didn't quite fit, with a glazed look on his face. I bet that he wasn't going to live long enough to ever look like a soldier.
"I'm looking for a man."
The commander's accent was sharp and northern and expensive. I felt the foreigner's arm brush my leg as he tensed. I didn't know if it was the soldier's voice, or because he thought I was about to sell him out. I gave the commander my best guileless blink.
Funny, most men round here are looking for a woman.
The words were out of my mouth before I remembered that he could shoot me in the head and call it justice. The older of the two soldiers coughed, covering a laugh. The commander just frowned, like he thought I didn't understand him.
A criminal. Have you seen him?
I shrugged.
Seen a few people today.
Fat Pama and her sons were in a few hours ago, and the Holy Father, too.
This man's not from around here.
His head twitched from side to side, peering around the small store. He started pacing evenly. His steps made the glass bottles of liquor on the shelf behind me clink together.
Is that right?
My eyes tracked him as he walked to the door of the storeroom and squinted through into the dwindling stacks of tinned food. Our supplies were too sparse to hide anyone there. As the commander turned back toward me, I noticed a fresh speck of red on the counter, like a drop of blood. I laid my hand across the stain as casual as I could.
You'd know if you'd seen him,
the young commander was saying in his tightly coiled accent. I smiled like my heart wasn't racing in my chest, telling me to run for the hills.
Like I said, not many folks round here today.
Not many foreigners, neither.
You sure about that?
Well, I've been here all day. It's quiet, on account of the heat and all.
You'd be clever not to lie to me, girl.
I bit my tongue. He was barely older than I was. 18, 19 at most. Probably the same age as the foreigner. I crossed my arms, careful to hide the blood stain, and leaned over the counter with a smile.
Oh, I don't lie, Commander. Lying is a sin after all, isn't it?
Where was Tamid when I needed him to share a joke?
But to my surprise, the younger of the two soldiers spoke up.
This desert is full of sin.
The commander looked toward his soldier in the same moment I did. I expected him to get a sharp reprimand for speaking out of turn, but the commander didn't say a word. No wonder the older soldier didn't work too hard to hide his laugh. No commander who wanted respect would let a soldier talk out of line like that. The younger soldier met my gaze, and I realized with a start that his eyes were as blue as mine. I'd never met another Mirajin with light eyes. Desert dwellers had dark hair, dark skin, and dark eyes. It was the Galen who had pale features. Just because they were entitled to our weapons, the Galen army seemed to think they were entitled to everything else in the desert. A couple of years back, the men of Dustwalk hanged pretty young Dalala al-Yamin after a Galen soldier took a bit too much of a shine to her. All the women in town comforted Dalala's mother by saying how it was the best thing to do, considering she wasn't any good to anyone now he was done with her. That night, I looked at my own blue eyes and thought of the Galen with their pale eyes and light hair. For years, I hadn't really understood what my father meant when he'd get into one of his drunken rages and call my mother a foreigner's whore. But I was 14 then, old enough to understand that folks didn't actually believe the dark-eyed desert man my dark-eyed mother was married to was really my father. I figured my mother had just been smarter than Dalala. She'd gotten herself married to Hiza in time to pretend the reason she was swelling up with child was him, and not some foreign soldier who'd caught her alone and against her will on some dark desert night. And by the time I came along with my contrary eyes, there was no admitting I was anything but Hiza's daughter, not in this town. Seemed the scrawny soldier had a smart mama like mine, just not smart enough to keep him out of the army. His mother's husband would have wanted to get rid of him, I reckoned. That's why he was in uniform, too young and too underfed and too smart-mouthed to last all that long. As his blue gaze met mine, the desert heat suddenly seemed to become stifling. The shop closing in around us, the air getting thick with nervous heat. I felt a bead of sweat roll down the back of my neck.
"Quite so, Norsham."
The commander's voice pulled my attention back to him abruptly as he gave another nervous tug at his sleeves. He gestured to his two soldiers, a sign. The older soldier leaned toward the younger soldier and said something to him before leading him outside, gripping him tightly by the elbow. It struck me as a strange gesture from one soldier to the other. I didn't have any time to consider it, though, because just like that I was alone with the commander and the foreigner I was hiding. And it occurred to me he might have just been getting rid of anyone who might interfere. I touched my hand to the rifle under the counter. The commander planted his arms on either side of me so he could stare straight down at me.
"This man, he's dangerous. He's a mercenary, and his ilk turn on a coin. There is a war going on."
Like he thought I could have lived 16 years without noticing the gallant soldiers in our desert.
"Miraji has more enemies than you can understand, and any one of them could be paying him. If it suited his purposes, he'd slit a girl's throat wide open. Except he'd do other things to her first, if you catch my meaning."
My mind went back to last night, to the stranger who'd stepped in front of a gun to save a kid.
"If you do see him, you'd better tell your husband."
I frowned, faking confusion. "I don't have a husband."
"Your father, then."
He pulled away from me, straightening his cuffs with a twitch. "Don't have one of them around, neither." I kept playing dumb. "I could tell my uncle, though, if that'd do." The commander nodded, seeming satisfied that I was just duller than a bag of rocks instead of a liar. I watched him all the way to the door, but I was never good at keeping my mouth shut. "Sir? Commander?" I called out, keeping my eyes down like a good, respectful girl in the presence of an officer. With my head down, I was staring straight into the foreigner's eyes. Something darted across his face, and for a moment I wondered if he recognized me from last night after all. "This mercenary, what's he wanted for anyhow?" The commander paused on the porch.
"Treason."
I raised my eyebrows at the foreigner, a question.
Below the counter, he winked at me, and I couldn't stop myself from smiling back.
"Well, then, I'll keep an eye out for him, sir." I waited until I couldn't hear the commander's horse anymore before reaching down to pull the foreigner to his feet. "Treason?"
"You're a good liar."
A small smile still played over his face. "For someone who doesn't lie." "I've had a lot of practice." His hand was lingering on mine, fingers against my pulse. I dropped my arm and looked up. That was when I noticed the red staining his white shirt, same as the blood on the counter. "Turn around." I sucked air through my teeth. The whole back of his shirt was a mess of red. "I don't mean to worry you and all," I said, trying to keep my voice calm. "But have you noticed that you've been shot?"
"Ah."
Looking at him closer now, I could see he was clutching the counter to stay upright.
"I'd almost forgotten about that."
Chapter 4. We sat on the floor behind the counter so that the foreigner could hide if someone came in. The blood was mostly dry, and his shirt was sticking to his skin. I had to cut it off him with his knife. His shoulders were broad and all hard muscles. They rose and fell with shallow breaths as I peeled away the ruined fabric. I was close enough to smell the smoke of last night's fire on him. I grabbed a bottle of liquor off the shelf. The foreigner sat perfectly still as I doused a clean corner of his shirt in the spirit and wiped it across his skin. We had more liquor to spare than water.
"You shouldn't be helping me, you know," he said after a moment. "Didn't you hear the righteous Commander Nagib? I'm dangerous." I snorted.
"Yeah, well, so is he." It was as much truth as I could give without telling him the blue-eyed bandit owed him a favor. "Besides," my hand darted up, "I've got the knife." He froze, feeling the blade against his neck. The hairs on the back of his neck stood up, and then he laughed.
"So you do."
When he spoke, his skin scraped across the edge of the knife like a dangerously close shave.
"I'm not going to hurt you."
"I know you won't." I tried to make it sound like a warning as I went back to work on his shoulder. I dug the tip of the knife into his skin. His muscles bunched under my hand, but he didn't cry out. As I tried to get under the bullet, I noticed a tattoo inked on his ribs. I traced the edge with the tips of my fingers. His muscles tensed under my hand, sending shivers all the way through my arm.
"It's a seagull."
When he spoke, the inked bird moved under my fingertips.
"It was the name of the first ship I ever served on. The Black Seagull. It seemed like a grand idea at the time."
"What were you doing on a ship?"
"Sailing."
I could feel the restlessness building below my fingers. He let out a long breath that seemed to make the bird fly. I pulled my hand away and felt him ease. "I don't think the bullet tore any muscles in your shoulder," I said, moving the knife. "Hold still." I leaned my elbows into his sides for support. He had a tattoo of a compass across his other shoulder. It rose and fell against me as he breathed heavily. The bullet pinged to the ground, and blood started to gush freely. I pressed the ruined shirt over it quickly with one hand.
"You need stitches."
"I'll be fine."
"Maybe, but you'll be better with stitches." He laughed, but it didn't sound easy.
"You've had medical training then?"
"No," I said, pressing the rag soaked in liquor against his back harder than I needed to. I grabbed a spool of ugly yellow thread and a needle off the shelf. "But you don't grow up round these parts without seeing a few dozen people get shot."
"I didn't think there were more than a few dozen people in this town."
"Exactly," I said. And though I couldn't see his face, I knew he was smiling. His fingernails dug into the floor as the needles slid into his skin. A question was building like an itch, and I had to ask. "So how did you commit treason against the Sultan when you're not even from Miraji?"
"I was born here," he said after a moment.
He knew that wasn't what I'd been asking. What kind of treason can a mercenary possibly commit? The question was on the tip of my tongue.
"You don't look it," I said instead.
"Not here. In Isman."
Mention of the capital struck too close to the bone just now, when I'd been so close to getting there last night.
"Though my mother was from a country called Sicha. That's where I lived most of my life."
"What's it like there?" He was silent, and I was sure he wasn't going to tell me.
"I don't suppose you've ever seen a rainstorm," he said. "So you don't know that kind of heavy air that clings to your skin and gets its fingers under your clothes."
My eyes went to my own fingers against his naked back. His shoulders rose and fell as he spoke.
"The air in Secha is like that all the time, and everything is as green and alive as this country is dry and dead. The bamboo grows so fast it might uproot houses someday, even in the city, like it's trying to take the ground we've built on back from us. And it's so hot, the women walk around with paper fans colorful enough to make the spirits jealous. We used to cool off by jumping in the sea fully clothed and trying not to get hit by any ships. Ships from all over the world. Albish ones with naked sea maids carved into them, and Sves ones built against the cold. And Sichian ones that looked like dragons carved out of a single tree. Some of the trees in Secha are taller than the towers in Isman.
"Don't suppose you're going to tell me what you're doing here?" I asked. "If Secha is so wonderful."
"Don't suppose I am," he replied, wincing as the needle went through his skin. "Don't suppose you're going to tell me what made you lie to our friend Commander Naguib al-Oman for me?"
"Don't suppose so." My needle paused in his skin. "Naguib al-Oman?" They were both common names, but all the same. "He's the Sultan's son?"
"How is it you know that?"
His head dipped a little, breath deepening as I pushed the last stitch in. "Everybody knows the story of the rebel prince and the other princes who competed in the Sultim trials." The story went that when Sultan Oman was still new to the throne, one of his prettiest wives gave him a son, Ahmed. A strong and clever boy, and even as the Sultan's harem grew and more wives gave him more sons, Ahmed was much in the favor of his father. 3 years later, the same wife gave birth to a daughter, but not to an infant, to a monster half-human and half-genie, with scales instead of skin, and claws instead of fingers, and horns growing from its purple head. Seeing that his wife had betrayed him by lying with an immortal genie, the Sultan beat her until she died. The same night, the monster child and Ahmed disappeared. 14 years later, the time for the trials came. It was the way the Sultim, the successor to the throne, had been chosen since Miraji began. As per tradition, the 12 eldest princes were to compete for the crown. That was just over a year ago. My mother was still alive. And when news of the trials reached Dustwalk, even men who'd tell you gambling was a sin started placing bets on which of the young princes would win the throne. On the day of the contest, the 12 sons lined up, and the whole city gathered to watch. Then a 13th man joined the princes. When he pulled back his hood, he was the picture of Sultan Oman as a younger man, and no one could deny his claim that he was Prince Ahmed, returned. No matter what suspicions surrounded the sudden return of the prince, the law of tradition was upheld. Prince Ahmed would compete, and the youngest of the 12 princes was expelled from the contest. That prince was named Naguib. I knew the name because when folks were betting on the Sultim trials, before the news about the rebel prince came, odds were that Naguib would get killed first in the trial. His prodigal brother might have saved Naguib's life by getting him expelled. Ahmed beat the other 11 princes in the test of intelligence, a huge maze full of traps built in the palace grounds, and the test of wisdom, a riddle posed by the wisest of the Sultan's advisers. When he came to the test of strength, trial by single combat, Ahmed won every fight until only he and Prince Kadir, the firstborn of the Sultan's sons, were left standing. They fought all day, until Kadir surrendered. Instead of executing his eldest brother, Ahmed spared his life. He turned his back on him to face their father, to claim the title of Saltim. Behind Ahmed's back, Kadir raised his sword in a blow that would have killed his brother. At that moment, Ahmed's sister, the genie's monster daughter, stepped from the crowd, throwing away her human disguise, and used unnatural powers inherited from her father to deflect Kadir's blade so that he missed. Furious at this intervention, the Sultan declared Kadir Saltim and ordered Ahmed's execution. But the young prince escaped into the desert with his monster sister to raise a rebellion for his throne. A new dawn, a new desert. I tied the thread and sliced off the excess with the knife. The foreigner turned around, giving me my first view of his bare chest. I suddenly felt like I needed to look anywhere but at him, which was stupid because this was the desert and I'd seen every man I'd ever known without a shirt. But this man I didn't know, and usually I didn't notice the muscles in their arms, or the way their stomachs rose and fell, or the tattoo of a sun over their hearts. He was looking at me in the fast-fading sunlight.
"I don't even know your name," he said.
"I don't know yours." I looked up, shoving dark hair off my face with my knuckles so I didn't get blood all over myself. I started to rub them on one of the rags that was still soaked with alcohol.
"Jin."
He'd given me a false name last night, though he didn't know it. I wasn't so sure he was giving me a real name now. It didn't sound like any I'd ever heard. "You sure about that?" I pressed.
"About my name?"
His mouth quirked up as he rolled his injured shoulder. It pulled the bare skin of his stomach, so I could just see the edge of another tattoo pull up above his belt. Suddenly, I wanted to know what it was. The thought made my neck feel hot.
"Fairly sure."
My eyes flicked up to his face. "Sure you're not lying to me?" His grin spread.
"Lying is a sin, don't you know?"
"So I've heard." Jin's eyes danced across my face in a way that made me restless.
"You know I'd be dead without your help."
"So would I." But I didn't tell him that. I didn't joke that he should call me Oman like I wanted to, or the blue-eyed bandit, or anything else I wanted to say. "It's Amani," I said. "My name, that is. Amani Alhiza." It was damn hard to trust a boy with a smile like that, a smile that made me want to follow him straight to the places he'd told me about and made me sure I shouldn't at the same time. "I can get you a clean shirt," I managed. I was having a hard time keeping my eyes on his face when there was so much else of him on show. "If you can wait here."
"The army will be back for me."
He scratched the back of his neck, inching the tattoo on his hip higher still. It looked like an animal I didn't recognize.
"I should probably move on."
"I reckon you should." I tore my eyes away. I couldn't trust him, I reminded myself. I didn't really know this foreign boy with a strange name, no matter that we'd saved each other's lives. I'd known him all of 2 days. But hell, I still liked him twice as much as the men in this town I'd known my whole life. And my life was what was at stake here, one way or another. "And you should take me with you."
"No."
Jin's answer came so quick, I knew he'd been expecting me to ask, maybe even before I'd decided to. He didn't meet my eyes as he spoke next.
You saved my life, and I'm returning the favor.
I didn't ask you to do that.
I tried to check the desperation in my voice.
I'm just asking you to get me out.
His eyes were fixed on mine, trapping me there. You don't even know where I'm going.
I don't care.
I caught myself leaning closer, too close when there was already nothing between us.
I just need help getting anywhere that's not here. Somewhere with a train or a decent road. Then we can call it quits, and I can find my own way to Isman. There's nothing for me here, any more than there is for you.
And who says there's anything for you out there?
The word stung. There's got to be more than here.
He laughed, and for that split second, I had the advantage. I took it.
Please.
I was as close to him as I could get without touching him.
Haven't you ever wanted something so bad that it becomes more than a want? I need to get out of this town. I need it like I need to breathe.
His breath came out in one hard exhale. I saw his resolve teetering. I didn't dare say another word in case I pushed it the wrong way.
Then the bell started, and the moment toppled. I looked round so fast I nearly split my skull on the counter.
"Isn't it a bit early for evening prayers?" Jin said what I'd been thinking.
"Those aren't prayer bells."
My heart felt like it might have stopped, but I was still breathing, listening long enough to be sure. "If the army..."
"It's not,"
I interrupted. "We didn't ring bells for the army."
"You should..."
"Shut up!" I held up a hand to silence him, to listen. And sure enough, I knew that frantic ringing, though it had been years since we'd heard it last. A few seconds later, it was echoed by others, bells on porches from open windows, iron clanging against iron. The sound sent shivers down my back.
"It's a hunt."
And then I was running for the door. Chapter 5. I barreled out of the store full tilt and near knocked straight into Tamid. "I was coming to find you." He was out of breath and resting heavily on his crutch. "You should go back inside."
"Is it?"
I started. "A Buraki," he nodded. My heart jumped in excitement. A desert horse. A first being made in the days before us mortal things from sand and wind. That could run past the end of the world without tiring. And worth its weight in gold if you could catch one. Like hell I was going back inside. I squinted past the edge of town. Sure enough, I could see the cloud of dust and men getting closer, herding the thing in with iron bars. It must have sprung one of the old traps. "It'll be on account of the fire in Deadshot," Tamid said in his preacher's voice. "First beings are fond of fire." I saw a crooked nail sticking out of the porch and yanked it out. Used to be, folks in this desert made their whole living gathering the metals from the mountains and sending daughters out into the sands with iron gloves to trap and tame the Buraki. To turn them from sand and wind to flesh and blood so that the men could take them into the cities to sell. Then the Sultan built the factory. The sand filled up with iron dust. Even the water tasted of it. Buraki got scarcer. Tents turned to houses, and horse traders turned into factory workers. Iron could hold first beings, or kill them, same as it could a ghoul. Bind them to mortality. But the only thing that could turn them to flesh and blood long enough to bind them was us. Tamid had read in some holy text that there were no females among first beings. They didn't need any sons,
They could just live forever, unlike mortal things. They didn't need us. But if knowledge was power, then the unknown was the greatest weakness of immortal things. We all knew the stories. Jean, who fell in love with worthy princesses and gave them all of their heart's wishes. Pretty girls who lured nightmares straight into men's blades. Brave merchants' daughters who caught Buraki and rode them to the ends of the earth. They were drawn to us, but also vulnerable to us. We could turn them into flesh and blood. Folks were pouring out onto their porches all around now, a nervous glint of excitement shivering through them. A Buraki meant either a whole lot of gold for whoever caught it, or a whole lot of blood, or both. The Buraki surged into view at the edge of town. Someone screamed. A few doors slammed. But most folks leaned forward, trying to get a better look. I hung off the edge of the shop, craning in with the rest. It was putting up one hell of a fight. For a second, it looked like a mortal horse. The next, it was pure sand, shifting from bright gold to violent red, fire and sun in a windswept desert. A trail of excitement that belonged to a long desert bloodline went through me. The factory had changed our ways. We weren't desert tribes hunting the Buraki any longer, but we still filled the desert with iron traps. When one of the traps was sprung, everyone knew what to do. A rattle of chains made me pay attention. The young widow Syra was hooking one end under the box of Zatar in her window, while the other got anchored to the prayer house by the Holy Father. Half the town was throwing iron dust out of their windows, the same dust every household kept handy in case of attack by desert ghouls. It mixed with the sand and air until the whole town was a prison for a first being. The Buraki reared with a cry. The men hemmed it in with iron bars, fighting to keep it from plunging back into the sand. The Buraki's hooves came down hard. There was a cry cut off by the crunch of hoof meeting skull. Blood splattered across the sand, gold and red like its coat. Uncle Asid jabbed the Buraki with the wicked point of his iron bar. The Buraki reared back, the wound shifting to flesh just long enough to bleed, long enough for the men to retreat behind the iron chains with everybody else. Their job was done. The men got the Buraki into town as one, but from there it was every woman for herself. If you caught the Buraki and managed to hold it long enough to trap it in its mortal form, then it belonged to you, or rather to your husband or father, or uncle, in my case, and the money from selling it belonged to him, too. Not that I was planning on handing it over if I caught it. Hell, I'd needed a new way out of here. Well, here I had one. I'd just have to catch it. The other women lingered on the edge of the iron chains. The widow Syra's tongue flicked out across her cracked lips. Even Shira had come out of my uncle's house. She seemed to be praying, her fingers laced through the iron chain. My heart was thumping through my whole body at once, stomach, throat, anywhere but where it belonged. 2 steps took me to the edge of the iron chain. This was my shot, my way out. "Amani," Tamid called me. I turned to answer. A flash of pink kalat caught my eye. Anfara yelped Shira's name as my cousin dodged under the chain and ran toward the Buraki. Damn her. Of all the times for her to decide to do something other than laze around... The Buraki, which had been tossing itself frantically between sand and skin, turned and charged her. She wasn't going to win this one. I dropped to the ground and rolled under the iron chain toward her. I was on my feet and running before Tamid could finish whatever warning he was shouting. I crashed into Shira, and we collided with the ground. A hoof clipped my head, sending a spiderweb of blinding pain across my vision. I started to get up, but Shira's hand clamped over my ankle, wrenching me down. Her eyes were almost as frantic.